Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Skullcast, the premier podcast about Berserk from the community at skullknight.net. I am your eternal host, Walter, and joining me today for episode 149 is only Azeel.
Hey.
Slim crew today. As you may have heard last time, we're still giving Gabola Tula and Grail some time off to be new parents with their baby boy. Hope to have them on again eventually. But we are at some pretty important parts of the reread. Well, you know, every part of Berserk is important, but as we lead up to the events in Volume 34, they're particularly world-shatteringly important. So we're going to continue on at our pace. So today we're going to be picking up Volume 33, and we hope to get through four episodes today between the two of us. So that should be no problemo as we go through this little chunk of 33, which is really all about Wyndham, right before the cataclysmic events that destroy the city.
When are we going to get back to the boat and guts? Bored is this shit.
Azeel's joking. I pulled some threads. I like to go back and see what we were all talking about the time these episodes came out. And there was a little bit of a kerfuffle among some users that aren't around anymore, people that came and went, right? A lot of people were just like, oh my gosh, there's more Griffith stuff. When are we going to get back to the boat and Guts? I mean, to be clear, Guts was just had a whole section about Guts and the boat. But yeah, it just goes to show. It's the recurring theme, right, is that people are impatient. And as you're reading the series month by month, you tend to lose track of the story flow.
There were always people unsatisfied with something at some point. There's always someone who's going to complain about something, whatever it is, no matter what they get. They want more, they want less, they want something else. It's never going to be enough.
The note to me that what's highlightable or notable is not that they were complaining, it's that they were complaining during a really cool part of the series, you know?
Yeah.
That's what's funny to me is this is like the last arc of humanity before humanity places its faith in the God Hand, effectively. And there's this big climactic battle. And these are the kind of quiet setup moments for that big climactic battle. And everything flows really matter-of-factly, despite how crazy it all is. You know, that's kind of what's the through line of these four episodes is humans placing their faith in something greater than them. And that kind of comes to a head with Sealat outside Wyndham. He directly addresses that thing. But you can see little thematic things happening with both Raban and Owen. They notice that they are part of a flow of something that they should, you know, maybe be criticizing or second-guessing, but they're not.
You're spoiling the stuff, man.
How's it a spoiler? Who's here that doesn't know this stuff? My point is, like, to me, that's the through line of these four, if I had to pick one. It's placing faith in something that they don't totally understand. But we'll go ahead and get started. I will start with my episode, Precognitive Dream. I think Dark Horse translated as Dream of Foresight. I don't think it really matters. It's pretty much the same.
Well, except Dream of Foresight sounds pretty terrible, though. Mm-hmm. You know, whereas Precognitive Dream is something that's understandable in English. Mm-hmm. Whereas you dreamt of a foresight. That's such a weird, I don't know, it's a weird phrasing to me. Maybe it's just me.
They had a foresight in a dream.
Yeah, kind of, you know, you just call it a precognitive dream, you know.
Sure. Here's a summary. We return to Wyndham, which is now truly a city of death. But somewhere inside, Raban has arrived with the survivors, telling them of the latest happenings in Vertanus. Actually, he's been there, right? He's been there with them.
Yeah.
Raban has, yeah.
Well, you mean Vertanus? No.
No. Sorry. Raban's been there in Wyndham.
Yeah.
All along with these resistance.
That's right.
Right.
We see him in Volume 37.
Yes. The Band of the Falcons successfully made all the Kushan forces withdraw just as the Holy See Alliance was about to be crushed. Foss says that he knew Griffith would return. Raban admits to himself that he also sensed it in his heart that this was inevitable. With Charlotte confirmed to have survived after the attack at the castle, and Kushan forces now centralizing in Wyndham, there are militias rising up across the country. But these stragglers in the cities can't leave without the women, held hostage deeper in the castle. Suddenly, children led by Eliza, Foss's daughter, relay a dream that they collectively had about the White Falcon. And I have a little condensed version of it here that I'm going to read because I found it cool how directly it alludes to things that will happen in the next two volumes. When the moon can't be seen, the fog will clear the city, and all the soldiers and monsters will go with it. People should stay indoors until morning and then leave Wyndham. Then a false morning comes because a black shadow hides the sun. Something dreadful and huge. But the shining bird calls forth a big storm that blows the shadow away, and then the true dawn arrives. The visuals here are, I thought the language used here as well is also very childlike. So I'll get to that. I'm still in the summary. Meanwhile, the Band of the Falcon and a small contingent from the Holy See Alliance are en route to Wyndham for the showdown. The pontiff is filled with energy and says despite his age, he'll last at least until the coronation. Until then, he won't be stopped. The bitter members of Midland's nobility are grinding their teeth, seeing Griffith getting so close to the pontiff. But Owen says, Griffith has deserved this show of adoration. And on reflection, he realizes that he is also being swept up into something larger than himself. But he's convinced that it will come true exactly like he's pictured in his mind. Mule comments on how few the Holy See Alliance offered the Midland forces to overtake the Kushans, and Locust chimes in saying it's politics. They don't want to give up their own men for the land they won't claim any. They can't claim anymore. And over Mule's objections that such politics are abhorrent, Locust says it hardly matters, because this kind of trifling affair in this world is meaningless already, because soon the morning will come and the true sun will illuminate the world. That's the end of the episode. I apologize for the long summary. It's not my style. But there's a lot of, pretty much every scene I felt was at least cool or notable.
Yeah.
Because of how it all builds up to what's going to happen in the next few volumes. So, about the dream, I don't think I really took careful attention about the dream itself prior to this. But yeah, it really does. I mean, they specifically say the shining bird calls forth a big storm that blows the shadow away. That's the blast of the astral world. And then the true dawn arrives, which is, of course, Fantasia, right? The beginning of the new world. But also, I like how the language itself, and I don't have a direct Japanese translation. I'm looking at Dark Horse's. It's all very childlike and simplified, right? It's not dramatic or obtuse, the language. It's the language of children interpreting the dream they saw. I thought that was a nice little touch as well.
Mm.
And it's not that often that we see children like this in detail, so up close. A lot of times we see kids in the streets, and I think of kids in Jill City a lot. And we see Isidro, but not a whole lot of kids. This is a lot of kid faces that Mira had created for this episode. I thought it's notable to me. It stuck out to me.
Yeah.
Let's see what else. Raban called in the thread. You know, he said, I knew it. I knew Griffith would be back. I said so in episode 294. You guys noticed this.
You mean Foss, you mean?
What did I say?
Robin.
Yeah, Foss. Yeah, sorry. Foss called it. I called it. I knew he'd be back.
Well, it's more like he's a true believer. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
I like that aspect. I like that aspect of it. The fact... I mean, I also like that we see Elise again, you know, Foss' daughter. I think it's it's a small touch, but it's cool to see basically Mira capitalizing on stuff he had introduced long before that weren't necessarily needed anymore. But, you know, he was like, yeah, you know, already got this.
It's an existing piece. Yep. You know, you may as well reuse it. So to refresh you guys' memory, this is who Griffith had temporarily had kidnapped to urge Foss to go along with his plan back in Volume 8.
To betray the Queen.
Yeah.
And so, you got Elise. And also, Foss, he's some kind of hardcore face towards Griffiths, which is also established at that time because Griffiths shook him up so deeply that he basically became a true believer. And I was always impressed with that kind of continuation. I mean, we see that in Volume 17 already when the king dies. Foss is still holding on some hope towards the Falcon, and then we see that again here, and I just love the way it's continued. And even afterwards, after the great wave of the asteroid world and everything, he still becomes this kind of hardcore true believer. And it's just an interesting turn for his character, I think.
Yeah, someone who kind of it's a very different character. You know, he almost is a new man. Because he was a cynical. Plays from the shadows, playing on the dark side of people's emotions is what it seemed like he was doing.
Well, I would say he was basically a politician, you know, referring to what Locust says, a guy trying to manipulate his way to stay in power and kind of a cunning, pulling the strings type of guy. But yeah, he was just, like I say, he was shook so bad that he just, became a new man, like you said. He found a cause to believe in.
Yeah. The other thing that I thought was really cool in this reread was seeing how the children lay out the plan and then the adults start thinking about how they might execute this plan. It's a very ambitious thing. How are they going to actually pull this off? And then Raban realizes how this works is if everybody had a version of this dream already. So everyone has their role to play in this big thing. And so he latches onto that and he realizes if they just go with their part, everyone else has a role too.
Yeah.
It's about faith, right? So this is this little story about faith. They have to place their faith in something in order to get through this darkness. They have to trust in a greater power that everything else has been prepared, which I think is really clever because faith usually has a very positive connotation, right? You think of faith, religion, people striving for a better life. But in this case, it's a faith in something that might not be great for humanity. So it's kind of this subversion of faith.
Well, I mean, that's a, that's a larger debate, whether faith is good or not. But yeah, the point is here is they entrust their destiny to this precognitive dream. And yeah, it turns out all right for them in this case. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we will get to it with Silat and Jai Stokes later on. But yeah, what's interesting in this case is that they do decide to basically just go with what they are being fed because they have no other choice in a way.
Right. We get a little prelude to Ganishka's final form here. And this, it's just a silhouette of what it will be, a very accurate silhouette. And you quite rightly called it in the thread back in the day that this was a form of Shiva, you know, many-armed goddess of destruction.
Mm.
But yeah, at the time, it's kind of unclear what it is exactly. It's something that can, it's a giant shadow that hides the sun. And the text alone makes you think of the eclipse, right? A shadow hiding the sun. I don't think that was an accident. I think that's supposed to be kind of thematically calling on, you know, that kind of dark, that dark feeling, that, what's the word, foreboding sensation.
Mm.
And then we see the falcon piercing through the clouds, which at the time you just think, oh, well, whatever defense or attack Griffith's or Ganesha's going to throw up there, Griffith's going to defeat it because he's the falcon. That's all you think of at the time. You don't think that when he pierces those clouds and brings the storm, it's going to totally change the world. You know, that's the little, what's the word? The punch you don't see coming in this.
Yeah, sure. I think it's basically classic imagery at this point. Seeing the Falcon of Light pierce dark clouds is something we've seen before. Mm-hmm. Again, volume 17. But yeah, of course, we at this point, especially at the time when we were reading, you know, episode by episode, we didn't. I don't think anybody expected the change would be that big. And I mean, I know I felt like for a long time that it wasn't just gonna be, just, you know, conquering the kingdom and getting the crown of Midland was going to be something else bigger than that. But I don't think anybody expected really such a huge change, even such a huge battle, you know, between Ganishka and Griffith and so on. So yeah, it is, that's the beauty of it. And to go back to what people were saying at the time, some of the people complaining, well, we already know Griffith's going to win anyway. Yeah, but you don't actually know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And what actually happens, nobody had predicted. And that's why it's great. Because you already know how it's going to end. But it doesn't actually match your expectations when it goes down. You know, that's what great storytelling is.
Yeah, we've said it many times over the years, but Miura's capacity to continue to surprise us, even if we're following it page by page very closely, that's one of his strengths, is to continually find new, fresh ways to, you know, surprise us while also, of course, maintaining a consistent course, you know, not huge left turns. Griffith does win. He does establish his kingdom, but in a way that's super dramatic and super surprising.
Yeah.
On to the rest part of this episode. We're over to the, they're on the way to Wyndham, the Band of the Falcon, and we get these scenes with the Pontiff and Charlotte, and he has this little vision of the coronation, you know, what he imagines it might be like. And I'm pretty sure that's straight up a Napoleon painting, like down to the like characters in the foreground. I remember looking at that before.
Yeah, it's similar. I mean, straight up, no, but yeah, it is reminiscent of it. Mm-hmm. And of course, what I always liked about this one is Napoleon is supposed to have taken the crown from the Pope's hand and crowned himself. So I always figured Griffiths would have to do something like that too.
That'd be great.
It's like, I'm crowning myself. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, that's what it is at this point. He doesn't owe it to anybody but himself and, of course, you know, the other member of the Godin. But, yeah, that would have been interesting. Anyway, yeah, it's kind of a cool imagery.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of those things that's repeated. I feel like I'm, you know, what's the word? I probably say this too often, but Mira has, I think it's at least twice here and in 337. The pontiff's like, I can't die until I give you the crown. And he said it so many times, I feel like it kind of has to happen now. It'd be weird if it didn't happen this way. But yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with that exactly now, but it sort of seemed like something that was sure needed to happen.
Yeah.
It seemed very pressing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're talking about what's going to happen, with the continuation from Mori and such, mm-hmm. No idea. I'm not sure he's actually going to get coronated. That's a good question, but it definitely won't be happening the way Mira had envisioned, I think.
Yep.
Anyway.
We have a little bit of drama between Sonia and Charlotte. Really, it's just her observing them together, her finally realizing what's to come. Surely she already knew.
Yeah, yeah, she knew. She's just, it's just more of the same where she doesn't like it, basically.
Yeah. And she's just making fun. Not making fun. She's having fun, wrapping herself up in Griffith's cape to look like a cushion, which is pretty funny for just a half page of comedy, but otherwise very serious episode.
Yeah, I think she's bringing attention to herself, like
it's
the kind of thing teenage girls would do.
Mm-hmm.
And especially Sonia, you know, she likes to be the center of attention, especially Griffith's attention.
Yeah.
So she's always trying to call attention to herself in stuff like that. And, of course, we got the classic mirror reaction with like, what have I got to deserve this?
Mm-hmm. Poor kid. And of course, this last part with Locus, you know, we regularly refer to this scene because it alludes to the heart of what Locus is saying is that humans are no longer in the driver's seat anymore. You know, it doesn't really matter. And the weight of what he says here, I mean, it should have been spellbinding to us at the time. I'm not sure that it was. Politics no longer has a place in this world is what he's saying. That's a bold statement if you don't know what's coming, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's basically saying it's a new world order, and humans are no longer in the driver's seat.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Humans are not going to be master of their destiny anymore, and this kind of infighting, basically. I do love the translation we have of it on the site, which is this kind of trifle affairs that goes on in this world. It is meaningless already. Soon the morning will come. The true sun will illuminate the world. And that's, I think that's a great quote.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
And you know, funny thing, because when I read this episode, I always have this this exchange by Locus in mind, because it's really great. But I'd forgotten that the Kid's Oracle in itself is great. As you mentioned earlier, it's very clear as to what it refers to, yet enigmatic at the same time. But above all, it's quite sinister, you know. And I'd forgotten that when Elise herself talks about the true dawn that would come at last, you know, after the false morning, I was like, damn, that's fucking, like, that's straight up sinister, man. It's like, what exactly is this true dawn that everybody's been waiting for? And yeah, that's Fantasia. And, you know, it's, it did surprise me. I didn't remember it being as strong as that, you know. So that was interesting.
Well, I think that scene is particularly powerful because of what he does with the kid's eyes. You know, there's a lot of emphasis on that page with the eyes. It's very emotive in a way that Mira doesn't normally do that, play that kind of card in a very, it's like a little heart tug kind of thing. But what they're talking about is a cataclysmic event where hundreds of thousands of people are going to die. in the True Dawn.
Yeah, well, probably millions. I mean, worldwide, it's
millions.
But yeah, it's interesting, especially when you compare it to Locust. He's got a really sinister look on him, like, you know, downright scary. So yeah, pretty just an interesting comparison between the two scenes.
The last thing I have is an almost incidental addition, which is at the very last page, we have this shot of Griffith on his horse.
Yeah.
And the very next page is Skull Knight on his horse, almost in the exact same pose. His arm in the same position, the horse in the same position. It's almost like it's like they're related in a way.
I think that's, I mean, that's just incidental, truly, because these are just stuff that were added.
Sure. I mean, someone said that'd be a good one to include, but they are related because they are each the emperors of their time. You know, there's definitely connections there, but this itself, its placement, it's just kind of comical the way that it worked out.
Yeah. Yeah. It is funny. I wonder, now that you mention it, if the editor who decided on that did it on purpose, or if it's just random because he has like five different images they can use and they just put it there. You know, it's a good.
I think that's the volume. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, while we're on that topic, though, I do love that last image of Griffiths on the horse. I think it's really gorgeous. And there's another one of him a little earlier, when he's you see the sun shining on the side of his face. I also think he's really, really nice.
So, yeah, the single panel of him, the bigger, the taller one.
Yeah. Love these two. I think they're really great.
Yeah, that was the episode preview, as I recall. Just that one little eyes glowing, far off look kind of shot of him.
Yeah.
But the Skull Knight picture, just real quick, I think it's the insert for volume 18, like the little dust jacket insert.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I've seen the full painting before.
Oh, I have a poster of it on my wall in Young Animal, and they also included it on some postcards, I think.
Yeah, but it's one of those ones that's like not often seen. You know, yeah, sure, it's buried somewhere in a postcard, or maybe they made one print of it, but it's not in an official art book. Or maybe it's in the catalog. I don't know.
It is in the catalog, I'm pretty sure. Okay. But yeah, it wasn't in the... It was done after the first art book, so it wasn't in there. And then, yeah, it was released, I told you, in some kind of... Like, it was on a phone card that they did in Young Animal. It was on a poster in Young Animal. It was... Yeah. I think it was... When you bought the Dreamcast game, if you had the collector's edition, there was a little calendar with it. And it's on that, it's among the illustration in that calendar. So you've got that. But yeah, it's otherwise it's pretty rare. And it's, what's interesting about it is that Skull Knight is kind of greenish in it.
Oh, yeah.
And the moon is blue. And that is why many Art of War statues, when they first did Skull Knight, they had him green by default.
Very green.
Yeah, like very green.
Ninja Turtle.
And so, and that's pretty much based on that. And which is, it's a choice. It's not the choice I would have made, but because he's not actually supposed to be green, it's just like an artistic choice Mura did in that one painting that he did not reproduce afterwards.
But yeah, I mean, if you look at Volume 10's cover, is Skull Knight orange?
Yeah.
You know.
So, but yeah, anyway, if anyone ever wondered why he was green in the Art of War statues, I'm almost sure, like, it's just my deduction, but I'm 99% sure it's because of that specific painting.
I always figured it maybe it was because he had, like, copper armor and just turned green over time.
Oh,
was
yeah.
Was it silver that turns green? What is it, copper?
Yeah, it's a silver, yeah.
Silver, that's what it is. Anyway, one thing I didn't say, I know I've been really long in this episode, but there's a lot to cover here. I think, I'm pretty sure this is our goodbye to Wyndham, basically. You know, we see this next episode with Ganishka in there. I guess there's a little bit more.
Yeah, we see. I mean, we see Ganishka destroy it, basically.
Yeah, and yeah, yeah.
I will say, though, since you mentioned it, that I really love how Mura pictures it in these episodes. In this one, it begins with a very, like, sinister shot with the dead bodies and stuff. Mm-hmm. I love how it's done. And then you get that, you know, panning over the church with the bodies and stuff. And then we got that very claustrophobic thing with all these people gathered around their lantern or whatever and discussing it. And throughout you see these broken down stuff like piles of wood and whatever. And it's just, I don't know. I find these shots very nice. The one with the fog as well. Mm-hmm. Just, I think it's a nice send-off, and in the later episodes, we see some great architectural shots as well. So,
yeah,
we'll get to that.
I pass the mic over to you.
All right, so next episode is Fog of Death. So we pan over Windham, outside of which Ganishka's armies are now massed. The Emperor himself is racing down a flight of stairs, clutching his face due to the wound Guts inflicted him. He's become desperate after his face-off against Griffiths, where he was effortlessly brought to his knees. He's realized Griffiths is on a whole other level, and that no amount of soldiers or pishacha would make a difference. So there is only one thing left. He will plunge himself inside the monstrous vessels they used to produce Dakar in order to transcend apostles and become something more. Daiba desperately tries to stop him, but to no avail. Ganishka drops down, and his fog suddenly rises up all over Windham, homing towards living beings in devouring them. Whether they're monsters, human soldiers, or monks, everyone's consumed and reduced to dust. Thanks to the dream, the few remaining Midlanders in the city knew to cluster themselves, while Daiba himself manages to deviate the fog at the last minute, otherwise everyone's dead. The episode ends as Daiba contemplates what an abomination it is for reincarnated being to be reincarnated again, and as he feels something truly evil rising up from the bottom of the astral world. So, like I mentioned, some great architectural shots in this episode. Really some nice stuff. You see a funny little exchange between the Kushan soldiers as well that I want to point out because I know it makes you laugh, Walter.
Mm-hmm. It's funny stuff.
Yeah, you always liked it, so I like that. And, of course, we see that that man-made Beherit. First time it's called like that.
Yeah.
But which is an interesting term for it that I noted at the time, which Daiba explains he spent his entire life building, or basically it was a culmination of his life of studying magic. So a very interesting tidbit. And we see it take on another hues with Ganishka's desperate move. So that's interesting. Of course, the star of the episode, I would say, is the fog that devours everything. Just very cool. Very cool concept. Very striking to me. Very cool execution as well. It does give you, I don't know, I feel like the way it's done is very dynamic. So especially when you see the tigers and, you know, the elephants, all that kind of stuff, they are really feel like they're blown away and dissolved. Mm-hmm. So just very cool stuff. Also, a nice touch is that Ganishka feels the pain from the wound. I don't know why, but I also thought that was so clever. It's a way to say that what Guts did, managed to do in Vritannis, actually had an effect still, and like contributes to his kind of frantic state of mind.
Yeah, so, it does.
I just love that detail. I think it's really great. A little touch. And I guess last thing I would have to say is... I do like Daiba's quick thinking and control of ourselves and the way he deviates the fog basically by making him turn around him in a helix. It's, I don't know. I think it's just interesting, and it, I wouldn't say the beginning, but it contributes to making him more than just a lackey for Ganishka, which, you know, for a long time, or at least in Vritannis, up until Vritannis, I viewed him as just, really just a lackey that would not outlive his master. And we see little by little that he's got more to him than that. Despite not being like exceptionally strong or whatever, he's cunning and resourceful. So just a nice touch. Mm-hmm. And that's about it.
The man-made Beherit, I'm sure glad he called it something, because I don't remember even what we used to call it, but... You know, they call it the Apostle Conglomeration, I think is what we used to call it. But yeah, it has a name. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Because well, it's hard to describe.
Yeah, it's not even a name per se. It's more like a comparison he makes himself. But it is very convenient to have.
That's just to refer to. You know that giant mass of apostle bodies that was stitched together and chained together?
Yeah.
And that thing.
It was a monstrosity.
As it's sucking the fog in, the fog goes out, kills, and it brings all those things back in, right?
Yeah.
We see these ventricles, and I can't help but think of the idea of evil because of those ventricles.
Oh.
And the heart and the sea god also has them.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. So it's just one of those things. Oh, I mean, come on. Even
Roisin.
What's her name? Roisin exactly
yeah,
has this
does,
as well.
Yeah.
So it just makes me think about that. It's also, you know, it's also talking about the bowels of the astral world. I just remember where my head was at when this was all happening. Like, what is Mira actually doing? What is going to come from the bowels of the astral world?
Yeah.
It's very enigmatic. The way this episode ends, I don't even know how I would begin to describe what it is I'm seeing on that last page, except it's the artificial Bahirrit basically, like, inside it. You know what I mean? Like, what Ganeshka is seeing from inside.
I was about to say, like, the appendices or whatever you call it, that sucking the fog, in and of themselves, I don't find them specifically interesting because they're just basically gross, you know, mouse or whatever. But yeah, that final page, I remember we're like, what the fuck is this? And to this day, I still don't know. I do not know. It could be, I mean, it is underwater, that's for sure.
Yeah,
and
sure,
and
sure.
Because we talk about the astral world, I'm like, huh. Huh, especially from the, you know, from the bottom of the astral world. So immediately brings up to mind the idea of evil, of course, because that's what's actually, you know, laying down at the bottom of the abyss, which is itself at the bottom of the astral world. So, I mean, at some point. But yeah, it's not clear and still don't know. Maybe, like you say, the inside of the artificial Bahirrit could be.
I don't know.
Could be.
I don't know. It's a very, and again, it's just plainly enigmatic, and it looks like something's about to boil over, and it's related to the bowels of the astral world. That's what it looks like, you know?
Yeah.
So well, that seems sinister.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it... the way I see it is, you know, when you think to Ganeshka's final form, he's got all these little, like, mini Ganeshkas basically all over him. He's become multiplied. And so I always felt like this is basically the beginning of that, like all this... Basically, his body transforming and forming these lumps that become, and it's something that's related to the actual way they call it. You know, when they call, so it's not in the episodes we're gonna see this time, but the title "Final God" or "Last God" or whatever you want to call it, which is how episode 295 is titled. It actually means, like the kanji for final here, it actually means also new shoots, like from a tree, you know?
Oh, okay. Wow.
And when you think about that, and I'm like, and so one of the notes I had for that episode that we'll see next time is maybe that translation is not so good. Maybe Final God is not how it should be titled. And I think it's not, I think it should be related to, yeah, something like, you know, like if you think of a tree growing and, you know, having many new shoots, that's exactly what Ganeshka is like in his Shiva form. So, yeah, that's what it relates to. And basically, to go back to these pictures, that's what I think it might be referring to.
That's really cool. I'm glad you discovered that on that. See, rereads, you never know what you're going to find when you open these pages.
Yeah, well, I mean, it comes down to checking every word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to give it to someone like Miura, where the concept here, if you just sketch it out, is Ganeshka goes into the thing, and then he reaches out with his the fog in the city, which is already there, because Ganeshka's fog is everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Recedes, and as it recedes, it's sucking out the life of everything it touches.
Yeah.
How do you depict that? You know, if you're an artist, we have a writer and artist relationship. The writer says, here's what's going to happen, now draw it. The fog devours life. How do I depict that? He picked a good way to do that. You know, very visual, very, you can feel it. You can almost hear it. What happens to the Pisasha and the Kushans, the way it's basically as acid, eating away their flesh.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it dissolves the flesh. It's very, it's a very specific effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he picked a lane and he stuck hard to that lane. He didn't make it abstract, you know. The bodies are being dissolved, and you see the skin and the muscle and the bone, and very, very cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that basically anything organic or living at least disintegrates. Mm-hmm. And also, like I mentioned, funny thing, it's interesting to me that he brought in a funny exchange. It's just two panels, but he was like,
describe it for those that aren't actually looking at it.
Yeah.
No, I'm saying,
sorry, you want me to describe it? So I thought you said for people who don't actually read the stuff.
I just mean, you know, they're listening to a podcast right now.
Yeah. So you see the soldiers being blown away by the fog, and like their flesh disintegrating. So they become like they lose their nose. They're like zombies, basically. And one of them looks to his neighbor and is like, what's with your face? What's going on? And the other one's like, oh. And then they both basically, you know, disintegrate into dust immediately afterwards. So
it's pretty funny because it's like the other one realizes, wait, if my face is like that and his face is like that, oh no! And then they blow up.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of a split second thing. It's like, what's going on? And they just die immediately. So, but yeah, it's pretty cute. Yeah.
Yeah. Good insertion of humor. The great episode. And you talked a little bit about Daiba. The revelation that he spent his life making this thing, it's the most backstory we get about Daiba. You know, we don't have a lot more than that. And he handed them the Behirit, right? That's it. That's all we get, you know? So I really would love to know more about why this device, how did he get so many?
Yeah.
Are these all the apostles in the Kushan territory? Is that why they're just Kanishka? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about it is I don't think, like, you can interpret the line several ways. I don't think he made it by himself and it took him like 100 years to do it. I think it's more he studied magic for a very long time. And once Ganishka became the emperor and Daiba came to serve him, he applied his knowledge to create that thing. Because I don't think, and in fact I know, Daiba could not possibly have captured all these many apostles by himself. So it's definitely
sure.
Something Ganishka helped with, or maybe even oversaw directly himself, especially since all the monks are using his fog to control them. So it's really all based on Ganishka's power. But it's basically Daiba is like, much like Shuruke, he's kind of like a scientist.
Mm-hmm. Like an engineer in this capacity. Like he probably engineered how it would work.
Yeah.
And Ganishka provided the components because he's an emperor that can do that, you know.
Yeah, and it's and much like, for example, a great scientist can create marvels of science, kind of a butcher working for a totalitarian regime can use his knowledge to create, bad shit. And so in this case, yeah, just the idea, chaining all these apostles or sewing all these apostles together to create that kind of living vessel, filling it with amniotic fluid by feeding them whatever gross shit they do.
Who knows where they're getting all that stuff from?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we see them being fed in volume 27, and it does not look like a pleasant thing. And basically, for these apostles, they are enduring like hell. I mean, it must be hellish to live like this. And then, you have to capture women, impregnate them by rape, obviously, and then plunge them into this thing so that the fetus becomes a monster. I mean, what the fuck. But I mean, well done, Daiba, you've created something. Not sure it's funny because when you think back to where he was being taken in terms of the story, I wouldn't say being redeemed, but you know, at least being kind of on the good guy side.
Yeah.
This guy is like, he's committed crimes against humanity. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Crimes against a lot of things.
Yeah. He's just
apostles himself as well.
Yeah.
But now he just goes around laughing.
Yeah. Now he's just, Yeah. Well, I mean, even not going into the continuation, but just he'd become basically been portrayed as kind of a nice old grandpa. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I did like where they left him because he was already past his darkest moment. You know, that's what it felt like. Like he's already over the hump on his life. He's already had his big campaign, and that ended in failure. So now where do you go, old man? You know, what do you do next?
Yeah.
Very visual episode. A memorable one for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, again, the whole idea of basically Ganeshka, in order to fuel his transformation, basically stealing the life of everybody in the city, just a very cool concept, which can mm-hmm. be, of course, because this is described as a man-made Beherit or an artificial Beherit, this can be equated to the way sacrificial ceremonies work, mm-hmm. where you offer up somebody for sacrifice, Void brands him, and then gives you evil power in exchange. Here it's not exactly the same thing, but Ganeshka is basically taking all that life into himself and using it to fuel his own transformation as he goes on and grab as much power as he can and tries to bring it back into the corporate world. So it's just an interesting way to make it function, basically.
Yeah, and I thought that as well. And I also think it's interesting that though he had the opportunity to lay it out crystal clear like that, he doesn't, you know? And so it's left there on the table as maybe it is like a cost extraction kind of thing that's happening because it is a artificial sacrificial ceremony.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not a ceremony and there's no branding or anything. So, mm-hmm. but yeah, I do think like Zopparel invites himself, itself. And, mm-hmm. I do think it's more of, you need, you know, to have power in order to do that, to grab that stuff into yourself. And if, of course, to transform his body, he needs to have, energy from something, you know, power from somewhere. And so he takes it from all these people's life, basically their life force. He mm-hmm. takes that and uses that to transform himself. So it's just, yeah, it's just interesting the way it works. We never told exactly how sacrificial ceremonies work, or even, you know, whether it's just for apostles or for members of the Golan. We don't know how exactly the exchange mm-hmm. functions. But clearly, there is an exchange, and here it's quite different. There is also this idea of you take something so that it can fuel your rebirth, basically.
Yep. I'll take it from here. The next episode is Silent Darkness. The summary is, as the fog of death has passed over the city, the remaining citizens emerge from their houses in a city emptied of cushions, just like the dream said. Raban and the Arklon Knights seize the attentions of the survivors, ordering them to evacuate. He notices that everyone is obeying calmly and without panic, despite the circumstances, and says it's because of the dream. As they explore deeper into the city, they find armor and weapons, the remnants of the cushions. In the prison, they finally discover the women, naked and held captive behind bars. They were protected from the fog by bundling their clothing over the bars, led by their version of the dream. With everyone now together, there are tens of thousands that need to evacuate. Raban realizes there's one more way the path for their escape has been prearranged. The armor on the ground. They can use that to disguise their identities and slip by the remaining guards outside the castle walls. And we see them crossing the bridge to freedom as the episode ends. That's the summary. We talked about it a little bit in the last episode, but the fog that passes over the city, it specifically destroys anyone who was not in an enclosed area. The Kushans died. Of course, the ones that survived knew what to do because they had the dream. They knew to, we see this in the last episode, close the doors, don't go outside, stay inside until morning comes. Then it'll be safe to come outside. I often shy away from making any direct biblical connections with Berserk because Miura just doesn't do that kind of thing regularly. He doesn't do his inspirations that directly or meaningfully. They're usually loose and flexible. Like, here's a building I plucked. Does it have any cultural relation to this? No, but I wanted to use it, you know. In this case, though, he literally calls the next episode Exodus in Katakana. And there is a very biblical Exodus that's happening here. And for those that aren't familiar with the biblical Exodus, it's about how the Jews that were living in Egypt were not allowed to leave to go with Moses to the promised land. And so God sends plagues down to the Egyptians to punish them, to make them relinquish the Jews. In this story, we have basically a plague that comes, and the Jews were protected from it by putting the lamb's blood over their doors as death came and visited all the houses that did not have blood over the doors. So they were protected from it because they were told, do this thing and you'll be spared. And in this case, the fog of death comes to Wyndham and destroys anyone who did not have that knowledge. So, and what happens next is that they are led away from their captivity here in Wyndham, and they're led to ultimately a promised land. So I can't think of all that and see the next episode's title in Katakana as Exodus and not think he really was implying biblical Exodus because of all the biblical-like things that are happening in this specific circumstance in Berserk. I'd never really thought about that before because, as I said, whenever people try to say Griffith's the Antichrist, I kind of just bend away from that whole idea because I think Griffith's Griffith. You know, I think Griffith is a member of the Godhead and unassociated with Christian mythology. But
yeah, well, in this case, I see for it. There to be an Antichrist, there has to be a Christ, which does not exist in Berserk. So that's kind of defeats the idea of it. About Exodus, it would be interesting to know what connotation it has in Japan, in Japanese, mm-hmm. if it has one specifically, because, in French, for example, the equivalent word, like its connection to biblical references basically has been lessened over the years because it's been used more commonly in the language. Mm-hmm. So it would be interesting to know whether it has any specific meaning in Japanese or if it's more like specifically referring to that. That would be interesting. But it's a good point for sure.
Here in the States, Exodus usually only has one connotation. It usually means the biblical. It has not been homogenized into different uses. It usually just means that.
Yeah, to me... To say, for example, that, I don't know, refugees are living en masse someplace, how would you call that, for example, in English? You have a word for that?
I'd say led to freedom is what we would say.
Yeah, okay.
I didn't realize until this reread that the bundles that are over the bars are clothing.
Yeah, it's a dress.
I thought it was, in my head, it was just like bed sheets and stuff.
What beds? They're sleeping on the floor.
Exactly, exactly. So, yeah, that's why they're naked.
Yeah.
Hey, I figured they were naked just because they're in captivity.
Sherlock Holmes over there.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, they put their clothing over the thing. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, actually, it's I find it very eerie, that scene. Like when Rabban and everybody, they come into the cells and they see them stuffed with the dresses like that over the bars. I don't know. I find it very, like, almost disturbing. You know what I mean? It's such a strange. And then you see Rabban when he comes in, he's like bent over and he's got that look on his eye. I don't know. It's just so. It's one of these, kind of horror-like moments in Berserk where you're like, what the fuck? What are they going to find in there?
Yeah. And until that, actually, in that next page reveal, you're not actually sure what they're going to find because they just went through a city filled with, you know, the remnants of humans.
Yeah.
So we have this little exchange with a particular girl, a young girl, who's relaying how, just like in the dream, they had their own dream. Of course, we all knew that was going to happen that way. What I think is really fascinating here is the sheer number of people that there are. You know, because this started with Rabban and the resistance, which we see as like, I don't know, a handful of stragglers. And then there's everyone else they meet up with, plus the women, and it ends up being tens of thousands of people that are here.
Yeah.
And then the problem, of course, the practical problem of how do you get these people out safely. It's fascinating here that a way was prepared. You know, that just like Rabban said in the first part of this reread, he has to place his faith in that there are other prongs to this plan that were already in motion. And that's exactly how it works. And he comes to that realization towards the end of this episode.
Yeah.
This moment. Next to Notre Dame as well.
Yeah, what I like especially about it is that we see his reasoning almost in real time. It showcases, like, he's like, how are we going to move all these people? We are not going to be able to follow our original plan. Then he sees Yamo, he's like, that's it. Like, he's got a real eureka moment with, like, okay, that's how we're going to do it. And I don't know, I just like that it showcases his quick thinking, basically, and all the while giving the reader a chance to figure it out for himself. You know, you're like, you see the thing, Rabban says that's it, and then you're like, you have the opportunity, you know what I mean, to find who is going to do it. I just like this kind of stuff. It's like when in detective novels, when you actually have a shot at finding out who the culprit is. I just appreciate that respect for the reader, basically.
Yeah, and it actually, Mira does play that out for about two pages, where he sees the armor on the ground, realizes they have this problem, and then the next page is this fake out of Kushan soldiers. Oh no, the Kushans are here.
Yeah, people are panicking, but, yeah.
Because you're seeing it from the perspective of those that aren't in the know, and then there's the reveal, they're not Kushan. So that's a little clever. I don't know how great a disguise it is, but it works, guys. It works.
I think it's pretty good, actually. I mean, especially like under the cover of night. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, were it not in that specific situation, it would be more complicated. But yeah.
We also notable that as they're leaving, the gates open and they escape Wyndham. There's other Kushans that are going in. Is that what's happening, right?
No, I think they're just, they're basically amassed there and waiting, basically.
Got it.
They're like standing at attention, waiting for orders. Mm-hmm. Which is, if you think about it, it's not a great way to keep your soldiers like up all night.
Yeah.
Waiting before battle, but at least that's what's going on. They're like, they're there waiting for orders.
Right. This is the eve of the, you know, final battle,
yeah.
Big showdown. So they're ready for it.
I guess they might be taking turns or something, or maybe doing drills.
Yeah.
We don't know.
That's all I had.
Well, I guess if I add a few more things, first off, again, love those architectural shots, including like we see a cathedral. Very nice one, if I do say so myself.
Isn't that Notre Dame? Isn't it just Notre Dame?
Yeah, well, we've got several Notre Dame in France, but yeah, that's one of them. I forgot if it's Notre Dame de Paris. It looks like it might be Reims as well. In any case, yeah, it is. We also, the prison itself reminds me of the Bastille as well. Just as the shape it has, but I don't know if that's the actual inspiration for it. In any case, yeah, very nice shot, especially at the beginning of the episode. We see those empty streets, again, very eerie, empty, silent streets with that lone fountain, dripping water. Just love that stuff. I do appreciate that we learn what the name of Rabban's company of knights is, Arklo. Just, you know, it's a detail, but I just like knowing that stuff. We didn't know. I don't think, at least, we knew what his family name or at least his company was. So just good to know that stuff, and noteworthy in my opinion. And I also like that we are shown or told that the prophetic dream works as a pacifier for people. That it basically it explains why they're kept calm, because they're following instructions they already got that are like supernatural almost. And I found that an interesting detail. The fact it prevents panic, basically, and makes sure everybody is doing things in an orderly manner. So yeah, just found that interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And it touches on what I said earlier, which is it's this evil power working for, in this case, the survival of these people, you know. But I don't know how I feel ethically about that whole thing. I don't know how they should feel ethically. It's this moral dilemma that's introduced in the next episode, which we'll get into.
Yeah. Well, moving on to the next one. So it is Exodus. Rabban leads Wyndham's population through the Kushan garrison outside the city, and under the cover of night, no one sees through the disguise. But they stop at the camp's gate and can't even communicate with the guards. So big problem. Just as they resolve to try and fight their way through, a Kushan courier arrives, bearing dispatch orders. This tricks the guards and they let the escapees through. The man in question is Jarif, a Kushan soldier who pledged himself to the Falcon and now works as an intelligence officer. Rabban's men don't trust him, but they have no time to pry as they get ambushed by the Bakiraka. Silat is surprised by their escape and not intent on letting them through, but Jarif reasons with him. He tries to talk him into joining the Band of the Falcon, arguing that there's more at stake here than just a reconquest of stolen land or a holy war. They're carried by an inscrutable current commanded by the Falcon and leading into a new world, one unlike anything ever seen before. Silat sees it as fanatism, which Jarif doesn't deny, but he decides to let them through anyway. He leaves them with a warning, however, born from a lesson the Bakereka have learned the hard way. Is it wise for humans to entrust themselves to that which transcends their knowledge? We fast forward to the morning as the refugees join up with the Band of the Falcon. Raban salutes Owen, and standing on a hill like a figure out of a painting is Griffith. So, lots of interesting things in this episode, mostly related to the talk between Silat and Jarif. So, a few details to begin. Jarif was originally named Jarris with an S instead of F.
Oh, yeah.
The name was changed in the volume. It's a small detail, but worth pointing out. At the end of the episode, very striking to me that Foss falls on his knees in prayer when he sees Griffiths. I always found that to be a striking image. And again, it shows that he's a true believer. He's really been convinced. And I think that's the power Griffiths had already as a man, that kind of charisma and that relentlessness that stroke fear in the heart of man and admiration and whatever and jealousy. And yeah, as what he's become now, it's like multiplied tenfold or hundredfold or thousandfold. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah. Very, very striking image. You mentioned Exodus before in Katakana. I do find interesting the use of the words Reconquista and Jihad in Katakana by Jarif. Reconquista refers specifically to the reconquest of Spain after you know, Muslims basically took it up. I forgot which caliphate it was. I'm not super versed in that part of history, but basically Spain was conquered to like the order of two-thirds, and then it was reconquered later on. So, yeah, specific reference to that, and Jihad, of course, referring to a holy war. So just in interesting references. I feel like there's probably not much to see into them other than Mura using words to sprinkle some color into the language, but still worthwhile and worth mentioning. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like I said, the meat of this episode is a talk between Silat and Jarif. Jarif is a true believer, again, like Foss, and he makes a convincing argument for the Bakereka to join Griffiths. But Silat is shown to have the wisdom of one who has seen how the world works, to me. Notable among the talk is his response that all nations behave in inhuman ways, that they even compete in terms of inhumanity to surpass one another. So that's an interesting, you know, response to Jarif basically saying, well, you know, Ganishka is evil, whereas we are going to bring up, an era of peace, and Silat doesn't have any of it, and rightly so, because he knows there's no perfect thing in you know, the human world. As you know, the big moment, of course, is the one I mentioned already when Silat tells him that the Bakereka, who have survived on their blood and sweat, know instinctively that something's off with the idea of blindly following Griffiths, basically. It's really quite similar to Gut's own philosophy of life. Mm-hmm. And it's a great reflection of that famous line from Volume 5 about humans using causality to defy a fate that transcends their understanding. It's really, I think, a direct reference to that and to the fact that, well, it's not quite a good idea, because then you become, in a way, a slave to forces you don't understand. So, yeah, that's about it for me. What do you have to say?
I mean, really, this is one of my favorite episodes in the series. I feel like where Silat is, he's at a precipice in this moment for him. It's a decision. It's a big decision to make. But he's been prepared for this decision. The things that he's seen while watching Kanishka, while serving under Kanishka, remember, he's the one that witnessed. He saw the artificial Behirit, man-made Behirit thing. He peeked in on that. He's witnessed Guts. He's seen what Griffith is. He's had his hand in all the different stakes for humans right now and apostles. And he has more understanding than most. Maybe even more than Jarif here. So he's making an informed decision, even if it seems like the wrong one for those that are blind, like Raban. It might be obvious what Silat and his people should do, right? They're being offered security and a new world, but you know, Silat knows there's a cost associated with entrusting yourself to a power you don't understand, because that's what he and his people did to get to this part, right? So there's such a cool enigmatic thing, a decision that he makes to strike it out alone, to go on his own, to not entrust himself and his clan to this, to yeah. this force. It's just a very, very cool thing. And yeah, to me, it does. It's straight from the roots of exactly what Guts would do in this scenario. You know, you can feel it that this would be the Guts decision, even if he didn't have this stigma associated with Griffith already. It's just the Guts move would be to do it on his own.
Yeah, I'd rather not entrust myself to a monster or something that's basically shady because it is beyond human understanding. Whereas somebody weaker like Jarif or those guys would be like, sure, I'm all in.
Yeah. And I think what makes it hit so hard for me, like why I said this is one of my favorite episodes, I feel like it's a berserk theme that Miura is pounding really hard. You know, he's not being subtle about it. He's making it straight up. This is like one of the allegories for Berserk, I think, is basically to criticize the movements that we feel part of, you know, to look at it with clear eyes and decide if this is truly the best path, that kind of thing. I think that's something memorable about Berserk.
Yeah, it's also like being the master of your own destiny instead of just following the movement. And I mean, especially for in Japanese society, where the individual is always secondary to the collective, where you have to be like bow out in front of the needs of the many. You know, it's almost it's what Spock tells Kirk. You know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one. But Kirk, you know, replies to him that in this case he would you know prefer. He'd rather save Spock even if he endangers other people. Anyway, it's to me, I see it as kind of the same idea. And again, it reminds me of what Guts tells, on top of the tower at Albion, that he'd rather save Casca even if, you know, the others have to die for it. He doesn't care. And, it's kind of that kind of mentality where you will not just give up your liberty, your individuality, or whatever, just in the name of something that you are told is important, but you don't know exactly what it is. You know what I mean? And what I like about it is the Bakaraka, they've had a shitty lot, basically. They were slaves, essentially, for the old empire. You know, and Jarif goes over that in the episode. They were slaves. Then they were outcasts, or casted out when the Empire changed leadership. They had to survive. They had to basically lower themselves to become assassin, which is like the lowest possible profession you can have, like the most debased profession possible. But they had to do it in order to survive because they couldn't do anything else. And they've survived like that, and they've been relentlessly training their bodies and in order to do that. And so they're so like viscerally rooted in that survival and in that kind of discipline and training and that corporality that, they would rather not go with the flow. And maybe that is what allows them to not just pledge themselves to Griffiths, whereas everybody else, whether it's Raban who just goes along with it, or someone like Jarif who probably saw the light and went for it directly, they didn't have what it took to resist. But Silat and his guys, they can. And that's what makes them interesting to me.
For sure. And someone like Raban and Owen, it's not like they really have a choice, like Silat is being offered here, you know?
Yeah.
They're between the meat grinders here. Someone like Raban and Owen, they're caught between two armies, literally caught between two armies here.
Yeah, and that's why what earlier you said, Raban is more like I forgot what you said, basically kind of like a ship that's going along with it. But
going with the flow.
Yeah, I think Jarif is more of he's a perfect example of somebody or like Foss, you know, who is just he's in it, like he's in, he's a true believer. he goes for it because he believes in it. Whereas Raban, I feel like even after when we see him with Rickert after Fantasia and all that, he's still kind of like, you can feel that he's still reasonable. Like he knows he's fulfilling his duty and he's being carried over by the flow, but he's still got a head on his shoulder. Whereas I think many others don't. It would have actually been interesting to see how that bore out, whether he would be able to, I mean, to find out the truth eventually or not. But
I think so. I mean, we've been over this before, but a character like Raban, I don't think he was destined to become a zealot in the same way that Foss was.
Yeah.
Like what he says about the new, you know, world that they're in once he meets Rickert is, has something to the effect of, that the old wars of humans feel quaint compared to the time now. And he kind of like says it in a way that's like lamenting that what the world has become, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, that's a tale for another time. Fantastic episode. I think about this one often. And we also get this cute little moment of Raban and Owen finally together, putting their hands together.
It's a bro moment.
Yeah, it's a very bro. It's fist bump. It's medieval times fist bump is what it is.
Yeah.
Clashing their forearms together.
Yeah, it's pretty cute. Friendship. Manly friendship.
Mm-hmm. It's from Predator.
Yeah. Raban is asking Owen if he's been, the CIA has got him pushing too many pencils.
Yep, exactly.
What's wrong?
And then we have this.
Yeah, Raban should have a cigar in mouth.
Yep. And that's the episode. That's where we're going to stop today. I know the next episode's an all-timer, 100%, but don't have time for it today, unfortunately. But tune in next time. We'll wrap up Volume 33, and we'll kick this whole party started with the final battle at Windham. Thanks for listening.
All right. See ya.
The Skullcast is a production of Skullknight.net, a Berserk fan community. If you like what you heard, please visit patreon.com/sknet. Donations there do not go towards the podcast, but instead toward our resident translator, Puella, who ensures that our members have access to high-quality, text-based translations of Berserk. Puella has also been translating interviews with Berserk's creator, Kentaro Miura. Many of these interviews have never been translated into English, so it's very exciting to read those. That kind of work simply wouldn't have happened without support from our donors. If you'd like to chip in a buck or two, please know that it all helps. Once again, that's patreon.com/sknet. If you have a question or want to comment on the podcast, visit our forum, skullknight.net/forum. Near the top, you'll see a section devoted to the podcast. There's always an active thread in there, so go ahead, leave a post, and someone's sure to respond quickly. Thanks for listening!